From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the United Nations Climate Summit kicked off in Copenhagen. Billed as the biggest environmental meeting in history, the aim of its thousands of delegates is to seal a worldwide deal to head off dangerous global warming. But that was before they had to contend with this.
Tonight, a global investigation into what's being called ClimateGate. Hacked emails that some say call into question the very science behind global warming.
The emails spanning the last decade were written by scientists based at the University of East Anglia's Climatic Research Unit in the UK. In some, they discuss tricks to fudge temperature records. In another, a scientist wishes he could beat up a leading climate change denier. And they also suppressed inconvenient information. This was fuel for the decades-old debate that has been heating up faster than the planet.
Global warming skeptics saying those emails suggest that scientists may have worked together to manipulate global warming data. Defenders say those emails are being used out of context.
Andrew Revkin, environment reporter for the New York Times, himself cited in about 14 of those 1,000 emails as a reporter, not a participant, says the skeptics' conspiracy theories are wrong and that the case for the role we humans play in the warming of the planet is rock solid. However, he says there are legitimate grounds for debate over when or whether we need to prepare for utter catastrophe.
If you are a foe of restrictions on greenhouse gases, you can find plenty of real science out there to support your contention. The rate of sea level rise in this century is still largely undetermined. It could be disastrous. It could be 5 feet. There was just a new study out of Antarctica saying that's entirely plausible, but there's no way to characterize the probability of it. And also, a lot of the understanding of past climate trends relies on data sources that are complicated. There weren't thermometers around hundreds of places around the world before 150 years ago. So you rely on tree rings and temperatures and holes drilled in the Arctic tundra and the temperature of the sea.
And as we shall see, those data sometimes conflict, but let's get to that in a moment. And come now to the question of the emails. How did they become public, and what's the response been?
Well, the University of East Anglia has announced an inquiry into how they became public. They describe this as a criminal breach. There are people who describe it as a heroic whistleblower. What they contain is thousands of, not just emails, but documents, including raw computer code, a programmer's years-long log of his laments of dealing with these confusing data sets, and scientists talking to each other about pending papers. And some of the statements on their face are pretty suspect. Hide the decline, one email said, about someone trying to pull together a graph showing warming that cut out a certain data set because it kind of went the other way. Many of the scientists involved have already posted lengthy explanations on the blog called realclimate.org. But there's still stuff in there for sure that reveals the sort of the ugly underbelly of science.
In one case, scientists put together a graph of temperature trends, and part of the graph derived from tree ring data, and part derived from thermometer measurements, and part was kind of lopped off because it suggested that for one important period, temperatures were going down, not up. Using nominal facts, assembling them artfully to tell a larger lie. Is that not what this graph represents?
I can't make that judgment. No one has dived into the data underlying these graphs, except the peer reviewers when the papers were published. I have to wait for the inquiry to be completed before I can make some kind of determination.
Putting aside outright fraud and fudging data, this email traffic and the logs that you referred to certainly demonstrate that the scientists involved were contemptuous and frustrated by their various critics. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. Many of them, I think, have had this kind of frustration brewing in them for many years. These date from the 90s. I mean, there are some that date from a few weeks ago. So it's a 13-year saga written in emails that they assumed at the time would never be public. And sort of like being John Malkovich, you're inside the brain of the climate science community watching this turbulent era play out.
Your name came up in a whole mess of the material. Tell me how you figured into this.
far as I can tell, my name is either on or in about 14 of these 1,000 or so emails. And to my mind, what's said in them is simply a reporter inquiring of sources about pending papers, about what they think about a competitor's paper. They're the reporting process. And frankly, if I came across any batch of 1,000 emails spanning the period from 1996 to now, and they didn't have my name in them, then I would be worried, because that would mean I'm not really doing my job.
Clearly, you discussed with your editors how you could report on this subject, since you're part of the story.
We disclosed in the stories that I wrote that I was mentioned in some of the emails. You know, we've put it all out there. In these times, transparency is unavoidable. If you're not engaged in an open conversation with the outside world, you're at the very least in peril of being misconstrued. Transparency and the interactivity is a responsibility now. This is just as true for a journalist as for a scientist.
Andy, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Science writer Andrew Revkin covers climate change for the New York Times.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.